Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up. As India shatters yet another daily COVID case record and new variants spread, could lifting vaccine patents be the game changer? I asked the UK government advisor, Jeremy Farrar. Plus,
I didn't want the Germans to have the satisfaction of killing me, of having me dead.
Her father, mother, and sister were murdered in the Holocaust. Now, former resistance fighter Selma Vanderpeer shares her incredible story of survival. Then,
I could never imagine generating that much hate from people who didn't know me, who had never seen me before.
On the 60th anniversary of the Freedom Rides across America, Charles Person, the youngest original rider, tells Michelle Martin about staring down the Klan in his new memoir, Buses Are A-Comin'. And finally,
these natural beings that we've helped, you know, kill off, they're there to remind us of what nature can be.
Giving new life to dead trees, artist and activist Maya Lin tells me how she's getting at the root of climate change with her latest installation, Ghost Forest. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The vaccination effort here and in some other countries has been a success, but officials are sending the public a clear message that it is not over yet. The UK chief medical advisor, Chris Whitty, warns the world will continue to see a significant number of deaths unless more is done to increase inoculations. And in the United States, Dr. Anthony Fauci says new variants could be more dangerous than the original virus. That urgently underscores the need to help the developing world. India, which just set another record for daily cases, and South Africa are leading the demand for temporarily easing vaccine patents. The WHO has praised the Biden administration's support for that plan. But not everyone is on board, as the WTO weighs a decision. And here to discuss all of this is Jeremy Farrar, a COVID advisor to the UK government, and he is also director of the global health research charity, the Wellcome Trust. Jeremy Farrar, welcome back to our program. How much of a game changer will waiving patents be to address the immediate calamity that we can see unfolding?
Well, it's a historic moment, and you know, give great credit to the Biden administration for bringing this forward. But I think it's very important to appreciate the time frame that will play out. Yes, the discussion at the World Trade Organization, I think, is critical. It shows that the Biden administration is committed to multilateralism and working with partners. Those are really important signals. But in the short term, it's not going to change the vaccine access, I'm afraid. That is going to come about because countries who have access to a lot of vaccines make sure they're available through the COVAX facility that the WHO brings together, the ACT-A partnership, and that those vaccines are made available equitably to the world. That needs to happen yesterday, it needs to happen today, and it needs to happen tomorrow. This is the only way that we can reduce transmission sustainably, prevent new variants coming out, and ultimately coming back to haunt all of our countries in the future. So it's important, but it's not going to be the immediate response that we need in the next coming days and weeks.
So just let me ask you then to fill in the gaps on that immediate response that's required, because, you know, how much longer are we going to have to wait for that very thing that you just said to actually take place? It was the promise of the rich and developed world at the very beginning that they would share the vaccine. We'll put patents aside for the moment, but they would, you know, make sure the developing world had them as well. What more needs to happen to make this take place?
Well, I'm afraid that this does come back to the political leadership. This comes back essentially to a small number of countries. It's essentially through the G7, through the G20, and a small number of other countries and regions. The European Union is part of this as well, to vaccinate their own populations. We all understand the need to do that. But many countries have now made great progress in that. Here in the UK, incredible number of people being vaccinated. Same in the United States. Transmission is now very low. The number of people in hospital dying and with illness from COVID in the US, the UK, and increasingly in Europe is now very, very low. We should be sharing vaccines today. The US, for instance, has about 60 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. I doubt if those will ever be used in the US. We could make those available now through COVAX. Some countries, France particularly, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, have already committed to sharing and have made some available, but in small quantities. We've got to do this at scale. We've got to get these vaccines, yes, to India, but also to the rest of the world. The rest of the world that is in danger of the pandemic continuing to spiral out of control in South Asia, in Central and South America, in Southeast Asia, and indeed in Africa, where it would be devastating. We should have acted yesterday. We can act today. We must act tomorrow.
I have to say, it is extraordinary, and you put it at the foot of political leadership, that this thing which exists is not being shared as rapidly and deeply as it should be. And this thing that will take a lot of time is being supported by the United States and others. So let's just talk about patents and patent waiving. The USA has said yes. The EU has said it's something that it's going to be looking at and ready to discuss, as well as President Macron. Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel says, no, it has serious implications. What do you think will happen? What will the WTO, the World Trade Organization, do about the patent waiving issue?
I think it's important. It's crucial it gets discussed. I mean, this is such a vexed issue. It's delicate. It's sensitive. It's been on the agenda for decades. We're facing a global crisis. If now is not the time to do this, there'll never be a better time. But I think it's a bit about sticks, but it's also about carrots. It's about realizing that manufacturing capacity at the moment in the world is just not sufficient to provide the vaccines that are needed. Unfortunately, those decisions could and should have been made in May 2020, when it was clear that we were going to have to vaccinate the world, that actually it was the only route out of this pandemic, that lockdowns and physical restrictions and restrictions on people gathering was a temporary measure. It bought you time, but it didn't exit the pandemic. The only way of exiting the pandemic is through science, but making that science available equitably to the world. That means diagnostic tests. It means treatments. It critically means vaccines, oxygen, and personal protective equipment. And we're at that stage now when, unfortunately, the investments were not made in May 2020. I wish they had been in manufacturing capacity. But let's make them now and make sure that they're available, not in 2022, but in 2021. Because if we allow the current transmission in South Asia and Central and South America to continue, then we will see variants that come back that escape immunity and put us back to some point in 2020. So this is a scientific and public health imperative. It's a moral imperative, but it's the only way that we're all absolutely going to get out of this pandemic, and that is to have equitable access to all of the tools that are needed. I think the World Trade Organization will come to some agreement. So, but let's not wait for the World Trade Organization, which isn't meeting, as far as I'm aware, until June or July to start those negotiations. For the rich world with access to vaccines, let's make them available tomorrow to the world that needs them.
So let me ask you then about the variants. I mean, how troubling are they? Already here in the UK, they say they've seen clusters of the Indian variant. How troubled are you by these? And can the existing vaccines deal with them, or can they be rapidly modified to deal with them?
Yeah, the vaccine technology and the science of the last 12 months is absolutely staggering. And the vaccines, yes, they can be adapted. And I believe that science can keep us ahead of the variants that currently exist. But we don't know the variants that we don't yet know exist. Surveillance for these variants around the world is very fragmented. There's a lot of surveillance in some countries and very little in others. We have to improve the knowledge base and the data around variants in the future. But the best way of avoiding variants that will come back to evade the vaccines and the treatments is to drive down transmission everywhere. That is the only route by which we can absolutely be sure to prevent the variants developing. And it is much better to prevent them developing than reacting to them with updated vaccines and updated treatments. Much better to prevent them arising in the first place. And there is a very clear route to do that. Reduce transmission and make vaccines available globally. And we have those tools today. The frustrating thing, if you like, is, you know, a year ago, we didn't have the tools. We didn't have vaccines. We didn't know that there were treatments that worked. Now we do, and now as a world, we have a choice. Do we make them available to the whole world and prevent this pandemic continuing to reverberate around for months and years to come, or do we stop it? And those are choices we make. We have the tools. Are we willing to make them available equitably around the world? And I believe that with the situation now in the US, in UK, and indeed increasingly in Europe, we now have the ability to both prevent infection in our own citizens, in our own countries, and generously share to prevent transmission in the rest of the world.
So very briefly in our last minute together, do you think that the news over patent waiving and et cetera is a little bit of a not a smokescreen, but it's something for the future? And this idea of the demand now to share those that do exist is getting a little bit sort of, you know, covered up, so to speak, that it's not getting the light that it needs to because everybody's talking about patent waiving?
It's very important the patent waiving discussion goes on, but let's not wait for those complex negotiations. Mm-hmm. Let's share the vaccines now equitably around the world. That is in all of our interest to drive down transmission. Let the patent discussions go on at the World Trade Organization. Let's commit to multilateralism and having those debates there. But let's not wait for that to happen when we can share the tools today.
And just very briefly, there is enough vaccine to go around, right? Because all these countries are hoarding them, saying that we need to protect our people. There is enough to go around.
There is not enough to go around today. We haven't invested in the manufacturing capacity globally, but that is being ramped up. And of course, as you see, almost every day, new vaccines are now becoming available and getting licensed and registered by regulatory authorities. So we will have vaccines available through this year to vaccinate our own citizens, but more importantly, actually now, to vaccinate the rest of the world. So this will become less of a problem in 2021. We just don't need to keep the vaccines back for some future date for our own countries.
Right. Oh, it's frustrating, and I can hear it in your voice. Jeremy Farrar, thank you so much indeed for joining us. Now, 76 years ago today, Nazi Germany officially surrendered to the Allies, putting an end to 6 years of war in Europe. The liberation of several concentration camps was well underway by then, with horrifying reality of what had taken place becoming undeniable. 6 million Jews were murdered in the Holocaust, including Selma van der Peer's father, mother, and sister. She was just a teenager when the Nazis invaded her home, the Netherlands. She became a resistance fighter and a concentration camp survivor. Now, at nearly 99 years old, she's out with a memoir called My Name is Selma. And she shared her incredible tale of survival when, both vaccinated, we met for this conversation right here in London. Selma van der Peer, welcome to our program. It's a really big honor to have you. So I want to start by asking you, what was it like there before the war? What do you remember about Holland before the invasion?
Well, we were not living in a particularly Jewish neighborhood, and we were not friends with only Jews. I had many girlfriends from school as well, and most of them were Catholic or Protestant. We knew one was Protestant and the other was Catholic and I was Jewish and so. But it didn't make any difference. We were just all friends. And I remember that very well.
You remember everybody living together.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then everything obviously changed. The Nazis invaded the Netherlands. I think you were 18 years old.
17.
Yeah. What did you know about the Nazis? I mean, did you know that it was then going to be dangerous for Jewish people yourself?
We didn't know 100% what happened, of course, because the Germans were very careful, very clever. They never told people, states or countries, what they were going to do. They just did, slowly but surely. And so we knew what had happened in Germany and Austria and Czechoslovakia and so on. But not really. We didn't know about the extermination camps. Well, not the public did, at least.
4 days after the invasion, Holland surrendered.
Yeah.
And somehow you knew that you had to get your sister and your mother to safety. What happened to you and your siblings at that time?
Well, not straight away after the invasion, because as I said, the Germans were very clever. We didn't realize what was going to happen. The Dutch thought the whole Dutch Netherlands government and country, people in the country, thought the First World War, they had been not in the war and they had been neutral. And they thought this was going to happen again this time. So people didn't think about the worst yet.
What happened to your father?
Well, after a year in 1941, the orders about against Jews started. Not being able to go on the trams, on the trains, in the cafes, or to sit in cinema, etc. But in 1942... the Germans, or the Nazis, my friend says, I have to say, not Germans. A Nazi started, Germans started to call up Jewish people. First of all, the German refugees and so, and then Jewish girls and boys and men. And I got my call up on the 7th of June, my birthday, 1942. And my father said, no, you don't go. And my father got a call up in October. And they were told, people were told by the Jewish Council, who were told by the Germans, no doubt, that they were going to a work camp in the north of Holland. That was the call up. And so he thought, and also they were told that if they went, then their wives and children would be free. Didn't need to go to a work camp. And everybody believed that.
And of course it was a terrible
and
lie.
And it wasn't true at all. That's what I tried to tell you. There were so many lies, slowly but surely, they told. And we were not, don't forget, we were, now we know what happened. But we didn't in those days, you see.
Your father was taken
yes,
off.
Yes, so my father went to that work camp one evening. And the next day they were straightway transferred to a transfer camp, but called Westerbork in the north of Holland, where Jews were later on all the time transferred to before being sent to Auschwitz, the extermination camp Auschwitz. They were also collecting wives and children, so that was not true either. The next day, we were not called, thank God, otherwise I wouldn't be sitting here. I said to my mother, when we heard that my father was sent to Westerbork, we better go and hide, because if they haven't called us last night, they will come tonight. And that's what happened. I went to friends who knew about a man who had addresses for hiding, and my mother and sister went into a hiding place in Eindhoven in the south of Holland. And they stayed there till 1943 when they were betrayed.
And did your mother and your sister survive?
No, they were sent straight away. They were sent to Westerbork and then to Auschwitz, and they were killed, murdered straight away.
And you, but not with them?
No, I didn't with them. Number one, it cost a lot of money. And number two, the woman only could have two. So you needed people, and it wasn't easy in the beginning to find houses where people were willing to take Jews in.
And she could only take two people. So what did you decide
to
do?
So I went to evening classes to learn typing and shorthand when I left school in 41 and grammar school. And one girl there, with whom I had become friendly, said, if there's any trouble, you can come to us. So that's what I did. I went to them and hid there for a week. And then her mother told me that it was getting too dangerous and could I please go? So I was then looking for hiding place again, and I went to several hiding places.
You joined the resistance. How did that happen?
They were short because all the young people could be not be out for that anymore, help for that anymore. And they needed to. So I said one evening, can I help? And they said, oh yes, would you please? And I said, yes. So the first week I just put resistance papers in two envelopes because we weren't allowed to have, papers weren't allowed to be published anymore.
The Nazis banned all that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you also had to change your identity. You were Salma.
Yeah. And then the resistance thought I was, a different name was better. Because by that time, the resistance had influence already with the main resistance in the Netherlands. They all had joined up with each other, luckily, and good. And so the resistance asked me, would I be willing to take another name?
Yeah, and you became Marga. And in your book, you write, ever since joining the resistance, I'd buried my true self. Consciously denied my essence, my Selma, the whole time.
That's true.
What did that mean?
Well, it meant that I hid it away. I went into hiding as Selma. I tried to forget that I was Selma because I was scared that I would talk in my sleep, especially when I was in prison. I hardly dared sleep because I was so scared that I would.
That you'd betray yourself?
Yeah. I had that all the time, actually.
That fear of betraying yourself?
Yeah. All the time I was imprisoned during the war.
Well, I'm going to get to the prison in a moment, but first I'd like to ask you to read on page 76 in your book there, the passage about fear, about how, you know, fear was everywhere, but you had to put it to the back of your
forget,
mind.
Yeah, you forget about fear. Because I was busy as well, like I was now. When you're busy, you're able to push the things where you don't need. You can't live in constant fear. Even fear is something to which you become accustomed. Quite true. And the job, the resistance job, becomes like any other job. Every day I did things that put my life at risk. I didn't allow the fear to overwhelm me. The desire to thwart the Nazis and help people in danger was stronger.
I mean, it's really a powerful statement because everybody wonders how they would act when confronted with such a terrifying situation. And from what I read, the most terrifying and daring thing you did was go to Paris to Nazi headquarters. Tell me about that.
Well, it was. They asked me to go to Paris because they needed some papers from the Germans and the resistance. So I said, oh, no, it's too dangerous. I don't want to go. I didn't want to go. I thought it was much too dangerous. But they said it was needed because they had people, two boys in prison, and they wanted, or a few boys, and they wanted them out.
So they had captured these Dutch political prisoners?
Yeah.
What were the papers that you were taking?
Well, I didn't see them, really. I only had an envelope, which I took back. But the papers were official German papers, which the Germans had to carry with them if they wanted to go into a prison or so. So the resistance wanted to go into that prison and get the boys out, which they did.
You then did get arrested.
Yes.
But well, not because you were Jewish, but you got arrested for your as a political prisoner and sent to Ravensbrück,
yeah,
the women's concentration camp.
Yeah.
near Berlin. What was that like?
That was horrible.
Because you weren't taken in as a Jew, did you think that maybe you would be spared the worst? What was going through your mind?
Because we didn't really know what was happening to Jews. Don't forget that. We do now.
Yeah.
But we didn't. So, no. No, I did know, of course, that for Jews it might have been very much more dangerous, in a way, being sent to Poland to work. And we did know, of course, that none of them had come back.
What was your experience in Ravensbrück?
Well, I've had some very horrible experiences there, too. But I survived. I didn't want the Germans to have the satisfaction of killing me, of having me dead. So I did everything to stay alive. I was quite lucky in a way that I became the secretary of one of the chiefs in Siemens factory. I had to work in the Siemens factory.
The big German industrial,
Siemens and Halske,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is now famous for all the kitchen stuff. Yeah.
You said that to survive, you had to maintain hope.
Yeah. So you try to do your best to survive. It was difficult at some times. I was beaten once, unconscious, when I couldn't get off the loo because my tummy was always upset, you see. And because the food and the drinks we got was terrible, or hardly anything.
When you came out, you realized eventually that your mother had not survived, your father had not, and nor had your younger sister. Two older brothers had, and they had come here to England. How did you reconcile, how did you process their loss?
Well, I haven't reconciled with that at all. I think of them every day, every night. Small things happen. And when I slice my bread in the morning for breakfast, and I half my slice of bread, I think of my mother when she buttered our bread. I can't help it. It comes into my mind. I try not to because I say to myself, it doesn't make any difference. You can't make it undone. But I can't help it. I think of them every day in that way.
Did you talk about it throughout your life? You're now writing this incredible memoir about your life in the resistance. Was the war something you would talk to your friends about, to your son, to your
family? No, the first 30 years, I didn't talk about it at all. Except perhaps that I had been in the camp, but not detailed. And a little bit with my husband when I met him, because he told me about his. And but not much either. And then the Dutch Association for Women of Ravensbrück emailed me or phoned me and asked me to go to Ravensbrück with the schools they go to. And I said, no, I'm too busy building up my life. That was another thing. I was building up my life, you see. I was trying to get married and have a child and so. So I was busy again. And so, no. And I said to them, no, 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 no. But then, a few years after that, they phoned and wrote and said, we're going to Ravensbrück for a week with a workshop with teachers, people who have just finished the college for teaching. And they're going. So about 80 of them went to Ravensbrück, and I went with them. And I said, yes, that's a good idea, I thought, because if I could tell teachers what had happened there, then they could tell the children. That was the whole idea of the workshop. And that's what happened. And since then, I've been every year.
Fantastic. Do you think that your experience, obviously the experience of the Holocaust, the history, will remain in generations to come? Are you concerned that the longer we move away
from
that? Well, a bit,
yes, I was. But that's one of the reasons. There are several reasons I wrote the book. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book. Because with the book there, and especially now it's been so successful, I hope that it will remain, yes. And I hope that people will talk about it still. And but a main thing is, because of the experiences, I hope that it won't happen again.
So I was going to ask you, what do you think when you see something
happening now? Yeah.
Whether it was in Cambodia or in Bosnia or in Rwanda, now they call what's happening, you know, in China a genocide to the Uyghurs.
Very disappointed I am that people haven't learned from the... Mind you, it is very, very bad what happens there, but nothing like the Holocaust.
Selma van der Peer, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
What a formidable woman. And turning now to another tale of resistance, this week marks the 60th anniversary of the Freedom Riders who fought to desegregate the South. At 18, Charles Person became the youngest member, traveling from Washington to New Orleans in 1961. His new memoir, Buses Are A-Comin', details the bravery of these men and women instrumental in the battle for civil rights. And here's Michel Martin speaking to him about his message to young people who are continuing that struggle even today. This conversation is part of Exploring Hate, our ongoing series on racism, extremism, and anti-Semitism in America.
Charles Person, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How did you decide that you were going to apply to be a freedom rider?
They must have had a very intensive recruitment process, because on an application, and you know, especially if you were underage, you had to get your parents' permission. Also, they evaluated not only your experience as a freedom fighter, but other things, other intangibles. And the reason I say that is that they wanted to make sure that your background was such that nothing about you derogatory could be used not only against you, but against the movement, because then that would be a distraction. When you got arrested, they wanted it to be because you were protesting segregation, not because of something else that you may have done or said.
But why did you want to go?
It was an opportunity to do something beyond Atlanta. Atlanta was just a local. And I knew we were successful there. But here was an opportunity that I could affect the greater region, because we knew we were going to travel throughout the South. And we knew that, well, we had heard that Alabama and Mississippi was a whole lot worse than Georgia was.
You were just 18. You were the youngest person who was selected for these first two buses, the first 13 people to board two buses in Washington, D.C., with the goal of challenging the continued segregation of buses and trains and airplanes starting in May. At this point, it was already illegal, but it was still being practiced. The route was to go through North Carolina, then to South Carolina, and then to Alabama and Mississippi. Like, that was the plan, right? At what point did you realize it was going to get bad?
Things began to get worse for us when we got to South Carolina, and we had two incidences in South Carolina where John Lewis and one and Albert Bigelow, were attacked. And in another little town close by, Hank Thomas was arrested and let out in the dead of night into a crowd when he was able to escape. So things had began to get tense, and we talked about it, that, you know, be prepared. And when we got to Atlanta, we had a nice talk with Dr. King, and he was warning us that he had heard that danger awaited us in Alabama. And he said, the word is that you guys will never get through Alabama. Now, we respected Dr. King, but, you know, we had a job to do. So the next day, which was Mother's Day, everything was wonderful until we got to the Georgia-Alabama line. And when we got there, a gentleman was getting off the bus. And what he says to me indicated that, things may get a little more difficult. And basically he says to me, and my seat was always the first one as you get on the bus. And he says to me, you have had it good here in Georgia, but you're in Alabama now. So, you know, that kind of perked my ears up. But then again, I said, well, hey, he's getting off the bus. But little did I know, in a couple of hours, I would see him again in Birmingham. But that's the first indication that maybe something was afoot or something was awaiting us in Alabama.
Did you have a sense of what you were facing? I mean, you've alluded to it, but did you have a sense of what was going to come?
I think our anticipation of violence towards us was basically they might yank you off a stool. They might squirt condiments on you. They might spit on you. Or they might even put a cigarette out on you. But that was about the extent of the dangers that we anticipated. Nothing beyond that, but we had no idea that the Klan had other things in mind.
Hmm. And what did they have in mind?
They wanted to kill the Freedom Riders. And possibly if we had traveled at night, they probably would have. Because people reported they had all sorts of weapons, and some of them had guns. And, you know, when they set the bus on fire, and what they were chanting while the bus was burning, it's obvious what they had in mind.
Hmm.
Many of them had just returned from church. This was Mother's Day, which is a very unique day in American life. But they really were intent on doing extreme damage to us. You know, there were no reins on them. They had 15 minutes to do whatever they wanted to, and they took advantage of it.
So the first bus got to, what was it, to Anniston, right?
Yes.
And then the first bus was firebombed, correct?
Right.
And then the second bus, what happened? You were on the second bus, and then what happened?
Well, when we got to Anniston, the bus station was closed, and which is kind of unusual for Mother's Day. And there were a small crowd milling around outside the door of the bus station. The bus driver gets off and he talks to them and he gets back and he says, I understand the Greyhound bus has been set afire and they're taking the occupants to the hospital by the carloads. Now, we knew that our friends were on that bus, but not having the technology we have today, we had no idea how bad they may have been. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, even to this day, the thought of a fire on an enclosed area like that is just frightening to me. So that's my indication of what had happened to the other bus. And also we heard sirens. But anyway, after they gave us an opportunity to resegregate ourselves. And when we refused to move to the back of the bus, that's when the Klansmen got on the bus and physically forced us to the back of the bus. And one eyewitness says that they stacked us like pancakes.
You knew that you were there to stand your ground and not to move from your seat. But when they're coming at you and you know that the Klansmen are there and you know what they're there to do, do you remember what that was like?
Well, I know that I should have been afraid, but I wasn't, and I don't understand why. I didn't feel any pain from the punches that they threw. I mean, I don't understand that. I just knew that I had to remain nonviolent. I knew that I was not supposed to try to block their punches or their kicks or anything like that. We were determined to be nonviolent regardless of what happened. Like I say, I could never imagine generating that much hate from people who didn't know me, who had never seen me before. How could they become so angry to the point that they would do the things that they did?
Mm-hmm.
Simply because I was sitting in the front of the bus.
You know, we're kind of in a moment where, you know, people get annoyed when a story that centers Black people, that focuses on their Black experience, somehow turns to the experience, you know, of white folks. But the fact is that these white folks did put their lives on the line along with you. And I just wondered if you would talk a little bit about that. I'm thinking about Dr. Walter Bergman. First of all, like, how did you feel when you saw that, like, a white person was going to sit on the bus next to you? I don't even know if that had ever happened before. And what went through your mind? And why do you think they were there?
That was one of the questions I asked them. All of them, I was trying to figure out why are these white people helping here? Because in the Atlanta movement, we didn't have many whites to participate. And Dr. Bergman and his wife, Frances, said, they told me that we're going to take care of you. And they tried. When we were attacked on the bus in Anniston, Dr. Bergman came to help us. And they knocked him to the floor of the bus, and they began to stomp him in his chest. And had his wife not, begged them, they probably would have killed him on the bus. Then when we got to Birmingham, James Peck and I, we were the designated testers. And so when we went into the station in Birmingham, the entire wall of men came towards us, and they attacked James, and he went down almost immediately. And I was younger, I was able to maintain my balance. But what we didn't know at the time, Dr. Bergman was headed over to the terminal to try to help us, and he was knocked down. And Dr. Bergman is 61 years of age, and here he is crawling on his hands and knees trying to help us. You know, he didn't have to be there in the first place. And I can never forget, and, you know, to me, then 61 seemed like a very old man. It doesn't seem like an old man today. But, you know, to think that from your comparison of my age to his, and to see him on his hands and knees crawling and trying to help this black kid, and it's, you know, it was just, it's beyond imagination.
Mm. You talk about in the book, and this is a really painful part of it, is that you talked about them streaming aboard the bus. You talk about them sort of punching you in the face, grabbing your tie, your fist, and, you know, punching you in the face and throwing you and Herman to the back of the bus. But one of the points that you make is that half of them really focused on your two white colleagues, Jim and Walter. You said two Klansmen held Jim's head in their hands and delivered hit after hit. Here's what you said. You said, "I'd never been punched in my face, but as violent as that was, the men amplified their fury even more toward these two white men who, in the view of our attackers, were betraying white values." What does that mean? How do you even think about something like that?
They didn't like what we were doing, but to think that whites would support our cause, that they would, their fury would be increased even more. So that's what I guess the intensity of their hate and the words they use to describe Dr. Bergman and James Peck. You know, it's just that they hated us, but I think they hated them even worse because they felt that they were being betrayed.
You know what I found really shocking is that you drove off, you were in shock. Most of you had been beaten bloody. Several of you were unconscious at that point. There were three black doctors in Birmingham. None of them would treat you. Why?
Well, I later learned that medical doctors are licensed by the state. And then I guess we were called outside agitators. And they didn't want to be associated with these outside agitators and possibly lose their licenses. And I never talked to any of the doctors since then. But I understand now. But thank God there was a nurse in Reverend Shuttlesworth congregation who did provide some medical treatment for me.
Hmm. How did you get out of there?
You know, faith is a wonderful thing. There was a photographer there, and he snapped a picture. And when the flash went off, and it startled them. And if you see the picture, they all look up at the cameraman. They simply let me go, and they attacked the cameraman. They beat him up. They destroyed his camera, and they thought it was a film pack camera, and they thought they had destroyed all the film pack. But one image, and to this day, there's only one image out of Birmingham, and that's the image of me being beaten. But they let me go, and I simply walked away. I didn't run. I didn't cover up. I just walked out to the street, and then, as fate would have it, a city bus came by, and I got on the bus, and asked the driver to take me somewhere.
It is remarkable, as we said, that yours was the first ride, but rides came for months. Some 400 people eventually participated in these rides. It went on from May, as you said, it started, you know, on Mother's Day and lasted through November. until finally it was determined that the government was in fact going to enforce the law as it was written. Was it worth it?
Yes. Yes, I'd do it again. You have to realize there are a lot of good people in this world. I guess that's what keeps me going. I'm optimistic. I was optimistic then, and I'm optimistic today.
I see you're wearing your service medals. So I do want to thank you for your service in that realm, as well as the one that we're focusing on. You made significant physical sacrifices in the service of this country, and I know that many have expressed their appreciation, as do I. But I do have to ask, do you ever think about that? Like, the irony of it, that you have been so willing to put your body on the line in the service of the country when it hasn't at times offered you the dignity and the equality and the opportunity that you deserve?
Well, what I try to relate to people is this, that when you look at your parents and you see how hard they work for you, and you know that it has to be something that's better, and you'll do anything. They gave you all the love and most of this that you have to make provide for comfort for you and your brothers and your siblings. And I think now, how did they endure that stuff that they had to put up with? And they worked on jobs and they were there every day and their pay was insufficient, not because they didn't have the ability, simply because the system says this is what they are worth. This is what, and it was just in my family. Most black men were in the same situation. I mean, it didn't matter what your skills were, and they built a lot of these companies. I mean, they were there because they knew they needed something to keep their family going. But in spite of two jobs, my dad also did side work wherever he could get it to keep going. And that's why I think he died so early, because he was just worn out. You just can't do that. Just year after year after year.
Do you have some advice, or I don't know if you'd feel so bold as to offer advice to the generation of activists that are now in the forefront? I'm thinking about the Black Lives Matter movement, for example. Many of the folks who are at the forefront of this movement are the age that you were when you got on that bus. Do you think, based on your experience, is there some advice that you would share?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's my position to tell them how to conduct their march. I appreciate what they're doing. All I would say to them is stay nonviolent, stay informed, keep your community informed about what you're doing. They need to know why you're marching. And you have to repeat it, because if you don't create your own narratives, other people will. Just keep your impatience. That's what happens. That's, we need that. Old people become content with things as they are. We rationalize them. But young people are impatient and they want to see change. And as long as we got that out there and that kind of enthusiasm in our young people, we're going to be all right.
Charles Person, thank you so much for talking with us today. It is truly an honor to spend this time with you.
The pleasure has been mine. And thanks for caring.
And so inspiring, another incredible story there. And finally tonight, we take a trip to the Ghost Forest. From the brilliant vision of artist Maya Lin comes her latest project, a sprawling collection of dead trees in New York's Madison Square Park. Lin, of course, famously shot to fame by winning a national competition to design the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. when she was just 21 years old. But more recently, her work has taken on an environmental streak, and she's joining us now to talk about it from her New York studio. Maya Lin, welcome back to the program. And we find you in the studio, and I think you're sitting, with a model and an image of the Ghost Forest behind you. So tell me what it is, because it's dead trees, but it's not about dead trees.
Well, there is a phenomena going on around the world. They've been termed ghost forests. Due to climate change, vast tracts of forest land are dying out. Where I spend my summers in Colorado, it's beetle infestations because the winters are just too mild, the insects are not dying. And one season, you'll see a little bit of rust on the tops of the trees. By next season, an entire forest can have died off. This phenomenon is happening in California. It's forest fires. In the East Coast, it's rising seas, saltwater inundation. So I was invited in to do a temporary artwork for Madison Square Park, which is a beautiful 1.5-acre site in the middle of downtown Manhattan. And I wanted to bring a ghost forest to Manhattan. And I wanted to raise awareness about this phenomena that's going on, a huge loss that is going on that people might not be aware of. In my art, I really like to connect you to what's in your own backyard. So these trees that we that I brought in and installed, there are 49 of them. They're from the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, and they have all, they're all victims of saltwater inundation from a flooding estuary that had come in and overrun its banks.
So tell me, Maya, how you got all these trees and what your visual was. I mean, they clearly all look very uniform, same size. How deep did you have to plant them? And how long will they stay there?
The installation will see it through all four seasons. We begun it with no leaves on the beautiful stately trees around it. Spring is now in full bloom, summer will come, fall the leaves will drop, and we'll deinstall the piece in November when all the leaves have dropped off the trees. So I'm trying to capture as well, as these trees continue to gray out and in a way start to decay, then the living forest, the nature surrounding it, kind of goes through all its life cycles as well. But as well, I didn't want to, at this late stage with where we are with the dire effects of climate change, we are emphasizing through public programs and through 1,000 trees being planted in the fall that will, within 10 years, more than tenfold offset the costs of our install in terms of carbon emissions, that we really wanted to focus on nature-based solutions to climate change, because I didn't want to just wake you up to climate change. I think we don't have much time left, and I think if we reform our agricultural practices, our forestry practices, our ranching practices, and if we protect and restore degraded lands, both land and wetlands, then we could absorb a significant amount of carbon emissions and protect biodiversity around the world.
Mylin, your works have been, to an extent, mournful. They have marked great moments of tragedy, but also hope. I mean, the tragedy of the Vietnam War, the hope of the Civil Rights Memorial in Montgomery. And this now, your climate work, it's about mourning, but it's about hope as well, about regeneration. This whole year has been about tragedy and grief, but you particularly have faced that yourself. You lost your beloved husband to a sudden heart attack, the father of your children. And I just wondered whether this was cathartic for you. How did you get through this particular installation in the wake of your personal loss?
Well, I think Daniel and I, you know, I came up with this idea for Ghost Forest when we were in Colorado. And all last year, we actually spent from March through August, the whole family, our two girls and I spent our time there. And Daniel and I really talked about the Ghost Forest and the beetle kill going on, ravaging the parts of the Southwest where we spend our summers. And I really almost feel this piece wouldn't be there if it weren't for Daniel. And in a way, the Ghost Forest is really reminds me of our dialogues and talking about, you know, how was I going to do something temporary in this spot? So it's a very near and dear piece to me. One of the things that I feel that all the works that have dealt with, what I call them are the memory works, is how can the past teach us to frame a different future. And I think what is missing, I call it the fifth and the last of the memory works, the memorials, though we start with making people aware of what is being lost in the natural world, we focus as much emphasis on conservation and hope. Basically, in a nutshell, when you trace an ecological history, if you go to the website whatismissing.org, you go to these timelines of species, rivers, cities. Oftentimes, people chose to live where there was great abundance. First, they polluted with sewage, then industrial waste. And then there's this awareness of what they're doing. Laws come into effect. And lo and behold, like the Thames hasn't been this clean in 400 years. Beavers now are swimming and finding their way back to the Bronx. Nature's resilient. If we give it a chance, it will come back. It will not only reduce emissions and absorb emissions, I mean, between Project Drawdown and the Nature Conservancy, up to 50, maybe 75% of emissions if you really push into the wetlands. These are huge numbers. And we could also make our agricultural practices more resilient and resistant to drought if we can bring back the life of the soil.
Yeah. And your work is really, really showing that to us and to the whole world. It's really a lot of hope there. Maya-Lynn, thank you so much for joining us. And that is it for now. Thank you all for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.